5. House Committee on Education will come to order. Thank you very much, members and guests. Today we're going to be having an informational hearing, and we're going to be hearing a presentation on history overview of Oregon Opportunity Grants. We will not be addressing the governor's proposal at this point. We'll be dealing with that down the road. And however, we are very interested in wrapping around the whole evolution of that particular program. So thank you very much for being here. I think today presenting we have Brian Clem, Vicki Markle, and Margie Love. Now, as you begin, I will give you warning. We have a House Education Fund, as you may have heard. We're funding education here as well. And what we would like from you is when you have the need to use acronyms and what have you, please at least give us the full definition and then the acronym, and then you can proceed to use the acronym henceforth and forevermore. So violation thereof is at least $1, and the rest of us will certainly check our cell phones, because if you don't, Representative March has a way to call down and make your phone ring. So with that, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Along with me is Brian Clem. He's the Chair of the Commission. And Vicki Markle, who is the Director of our Grants and Scholarships Division. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I think the committee members have got a packet on your desks that we're going to be speaking from this afternoon. If the committee members have questions, please feel free to make this a more spontaneous discussion. We wanted to start off by giving the committee some background in what the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is in terms of its broader programs, and some very brief information about recent changes that you may have read about in the press about what our services are. The mission of the Student Assistance Commission is to assist Oregon students and their families in attaining a post-secondary education and to enhance the value, integrity, and diversity of Oregon's college programs. Our programs address most particularly three of the Oregon benchmarks, which are very much focused on post-secondary education. The first benchmark is number 24, where we're all striving to help more Oregon adults to complete some college. At benchmark number 25, where our focus is to increase the percentage of students and adults who have post-secondary professional and technical credentials, that they would have finished their college education and be prepared to help Oregon in many different ways. And the third one is benchmark 26A, which is to increase the percentage of Oregon adults who have completed a bachelor's degree or an advanced degree. In the 2005-07 budget, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission will provide two key functions. One, the administration of Oregon's public grants and scholarships, one of which is why we're here today, and that's to talk about the Oregon Opportunity Grant, oftentimes also referred to as the NEED grants that Oregon administers. But in addition to that, we also oversee over 300 private scholarships that students can apply for with a single application. A great benefit to them who have very limited time. And the second program that we will be administering in the next biennium is the Office of Degree Authorization, which makes sure that the credentials that students earn are bona fide and really represent a value to them, because education is something that people pay a great deal of value for, and we want to make sure that that value is bona fide. The recent news that I was speaking to earlier in my remarks had to do with the Oregon Student Loan Program. This is a program that had been administered for over 30 years, almost 40 years in Oregon, by the Student Assistance Commission. And because of a lot of rapid changes in the student loan market, the program was becoming less and less viable for Oregon to directly administer. The advent of the direct loan program, which many of our colleges took advantage of to be able to offer direct financing to students between themselves and the U.S. Department of Education, took away about three-quarters of the loan market that had previously been administered by the Student Assistance Commission. That transition reduced the amount of fee revenues that the agency received back from the federal government, but it didn't reduce proportionally all of the administrative costs in overseeing that program. The commission this last summer spent a great deal of time working through the process of exploring all of the various options that were available to Oregon students and colleges, and came to the conclusion that it was really in the best interest to develop an exit strategy where the program would be moved to another entity. Throughout the fall, we issued a request for proposal seeking other possible vendors to pick up the program. Unfortunately, on December 3rd, the closing date for that request for proposal, we received no bids. We communicated this with the U.S. Department of Education shortly after that, and at that point they asked for the intervention of another organization that they contract with to step in to pick up these services for states that have difficulties in continuing the program. In Oregon, that new entity is going to be the Educational Credit Management Corporation. As you can see by the initials, we refer to them as ECMC. The other is a bit of a mouthful. That transition became effective as of January 1st, 2005. We are in a process of transition with them right now in migrating all of the information that we have on databases and in paper files to transfer all of those records and transactions to the Educational Credit Management Corporation. Unfortunately, we have not been able to place all of our employees in other state service or in other employment. The process for transition related to the employees who are engaged in this activity will be concluding next Monday. We will be laying off, I believe, 5 employees, but fortunately, about 30 other employees over the recent months and even days have been able to find placement in other state agencies or have been picked up as employees in this new ECMC organization. That's really important to us because we wanted to make sure that the service delivery system was seamless and that there was not a disruption in our services to schools, borrowers, or the students and the banks that are involved as partners on this program. I'll take just a little bit of a pause right here and see if you have any questions about any of that before we move on into the details about the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Any questions for Ms. Lau? And I apologize for mispronouncing your name at the outset.
No problem.
Looks like we may proceed.
Okay. If you want to turn on to the next page, this is where we're going to get into what the eligibility processes are for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Vicki Merkel is going to be speaking to that in particular. And we're going to talk about first the broader procedures, and then we're going to give you some examples of some students. We've changed the names for the confidentiality purposes, but these are real live individuals and their circumstances, so you can see how the program is directly applied to our end recipients of the resources.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vicki Merkel, the Grants and Scholarships Division Director. Before I start talking about the Opportunity Grant, I did not want to confuse you. We have included the scholarship application in your materials. Students do not apply for the Opportunity Grant through this application. This is a separate way we give away private and various other public dollars, so I just wanted to clarify that. I'm just going to walk you through the general information about the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Eligibility criteria for students. To meet all of the eligibility requirements, the student must be a citizen or an eligible non-citizen. We use the same requirements as the free application for federal student aid or FAFSA. There, I got that one out of the way.
Right.
They must also be a resident of Oregon. An undergraduate student, the Opportunity Grant is not for graduate school. They have to be financially needy. We do have a needs test that I'll explain as we go along. They must be enrolled full-time, which is usually defined as 12 credit hours by the institution. And they must be enrolled in an eligible degree-granting program at a participating 2 or 4 year Oregon post-secondary institution. It is not for colleges out of state. And they have to apply annually, again by completing the free application for federal student aid. There are other eligibility criteria as well, and this is really important, I think, to understand, is that the student must be making satisfactory academic progress at the institution in order to continue receiving the opportunity grant. And satisfactory academic progress, or SAP, you're going to catch me a lot here, I know.
You're doing well.
Okay. I'm trying really, really hard.
That's the point.
Okay. That's defined by the institution. The students, in order to receive the opportunity grant, have to be admitted to a post-secondary institution, and then they have to continue making satisfactory academic progress. A student may not be in default for a student loan. They must register, if a male, with the Selective Service, and also cannot have any drug conviction. Part of the funds that we receive that match the Oregon General Fund are federal funds, so we have to comply with federal regulations. Also, students who are incarcerated are not eligible. The application and award process, again, Oregon's used the, can I now say FAFSA?
Yes.
Okay. and we at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission are the federally designated state holder of FAFSA records. So we have the ability to draw down the information from every student from Oregon who uses the FAFSA application. We can draw down, we designate which data bits that we need in order to process the student's application. And at this point, you may hear at some point talk of an estimated family contribution, or EFC, which is a federal formula for delivering or deciding how much a family can pay for college. And if you are ever in the position to be reading an EFC number personally for your student, you should be sitting down, because it tends to be a number that most people have a little difficulty understanding how they could ever come up with that amount of money, but it's a federal calculation. We do not use that methodology, but we use data to determine median family income from the FAFSA application. So I wanted to clarify that. The process begins now in January as students, the FAFSA goes online, or the paper application is available, and the student begins applying. We have staff in our office who are busy converting all this data in a way that will be usable for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So we work very hard beginning in January to get ready for our student records. In spring, traditionally, OSAC has had to determine cutoff dates by institutional segment. Historically, the number of eligible students has exceeded available funding. So we use cutoff dates to determine how to keep an equitable distribution of aid among the college segments. And we try to make that model for between the three segments, two-year publics, four-year publics, and four-year privates, the proportion to be equal, the proportion of numbers of students served. We use a model that's been developed in-house to determine this based on Oregon FAFSA filers, and we look at a great deal of historical data to make our projections. And then in August, we begin notifying the schools, again electronically, as to which students are available. If the student indeed has shown up and enrolled, then advance the funds to the school. The annual award amount for the opportunity grant. As a current policy, the annual award amounts are equal to the common percentage of cost for all institutions, and currently that's 11% of cost as determined by OSAC. The cost that we use is the sum of tuition and fees, plus a calculated weight average of non-tuition costs, and those non-tuition costs would include books, supplies, room and board, transportation, and a modest allowance for personal miscellaneous expenses. Award amounts are based on students' costs for the previous year, so we're always running a year behind for the institutional costs of tuition and fees. And currently, they do vary in size by the type of institution. Funds are disbursed to students in two or three installments, depending on if they're going to a semester or a term school. The award amounts for the two public institutional segments are based on an average. However, the award amounts for private 4 years are linked directly to the cost of attendance at that school, because those amounts vary so greatly between the private schools.
Ms. Merkel?
Yes.
You indicated that in August there are some funds advanced to the school, and then award amounts are based on student costs and then advanced to the students. And so initially the initial funds are sent to the school, and then from that point forward they're distributed to the students.
That's correct.
Thank you. And I had one more question before you get too far down the trail, so
okay.
I need to pause. On the first page, talking about eligibility requirements, you wanted the first point being a citizen or eligible non-citizen.
Yes.
What is the non-citizen eligibility?
I have to read it from the application, if that's correct. Generally, you are an eligible non-citizen if you are, one, a U.S. permanent resident and have an alien registration receipt card, two, a conditional permanent resident, three, an other eligible non-citizen with an arrival departure record from the Department of Homeland Security showing any one of the following designations: refugee, asylum granted, or parolee. I-94 confirms paroled for a minimum of 1 year and status has not expired, or Cuban Haitian entrant. If you are in the U.S. As an F1 or F2 student visa, an exchange visitor visa, or a G-series visa, you must fill in the application also. And we follow that here in Oregon. We use the same definitions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Dahlin.
Are these, is the grant equalized over the student population, opportunity grant, guaranteed student loan, and scholarship? Is there an equalizing process so that, or a leveling process so that all students get some, or are scholarships not, other scholarships not considered in the program?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, no. Student loans are available, and Margie and Brian can certainly chime in here also, to most students. It's fairly easy, unfortunately, in my mind in some cases, to receive a student loan. So those I would say are pretty accessible throughout the student population. Scholarships tend to be merit-based. There are two types of scholarships: institutional scholarships that the post-secondary institution will award, generally based on merit, but they may have some more latitude. And then private scholarships, which are designated by the private donor who decides which type of student they would like to see receive their private funding.
Madam Chair, Representative Dale, the criteria varies in terms of the grant size more by what the cost is of the particular institution that the student's going to attend. And as we get into the examples, you'll have a chance to see how that varies depending upon that institution choice for the student. Some of the federal assistance is also then stair-stepped based on the amount of family funds available. You're more likely to be able to receive federal assistance under the Pell Grant than what you are under the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Our cutoff point is much lower than the federal Pell Grant. But you'll see that as we get into some of the examples.
Thank you for pausing.
Certainly. The duration of the awards, the Oregon Opportunity Grant support, can only be received for 12 terms or 8 semesters. And again, the applicants must continue to satisfy all of the criteria, including the satisfactory academic progress. On page 3, you'll see the income thresholds for Oregon Opportunity Grant eligibility. This gives you a snapshot for a small sample of students: dependent students, independent students, and single independent students. The income thresholds used to determine a student's eligibility are based on an average of the most recent 3 years of median family income data for Oregon, as published by the U.S. Census Bureau. Before the start of the 2002-03 academic year, the commission staff determined that program funds were not sufficient to keep pace with increasing number of applicants. So for the 2002-03 academic year, the commission board opted to freeze income thresholds at the 2001-02 for all but single independent students. And then starting with 2003-04, the commission again had to make a difficult decision to lower income thresholds from 75% to 55%, which is where they currently stand. Income thresholds for independent students remain unchanged at 50%, and independent students with dependents, for independent students with dependents, and 30% for single independent students. But we've provided you with several case studies. The following four case studies illustrate various types of funding needs among Oregon's population of students. Several of these do show a funding gap between the students' cost of college and available public assistance. And I'd like to just review here the bulleted points of potential types of student funding. The school-based federal programs, and these vary by institution how available they are, the federal Perkins Loan, federal work study, and the federal SEOG program.
I was just going to ask you what SEOG is.
And I had written it out here, too. The Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant.
Well, that's wonderful, and we'll catch you later.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
I'll keep the running.
Okay.
As soon as it came out. The institutional aid, that's where the school itself can grant, provide grants and scholarships, tuition waivers, or institutional loans for the student. And then private sources of aid, privately funded scholarships, private alternative loans, which might be something like your home equity loan or, unfortunately, a Visa card. It could be part-time jobs, Federal Plus loans, that's the parent loan, and it's based on the parent's credit rating. And then family resources. And I do want to point out to you that 91% of the students eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant are from families with federally calculated expected family contributions, that EFC, of less than $1,000. We are really talking about Oregon's neediest students. The following examples are based on real students, but of course we've changed their names. Student number one, Shauna, is 23. She's starting her second year at a four-year private independent college. She's still considered a dependent student this year. She will become an independent student when she reaches age 24. She'll be able to borrow up to an additional $5,000 in student loans when she becomes an independent student. Her parents have a combined family income of $29,923. She earned $1,398 from a part-time job, and her federally calculated expected family contribution is $28. So that makes her eligible for the maximum Pell amount, the federal Pell grant of $4,050. Okay. There are four people in Shauna's family with two in college. Since her family's income falls below the opportunity grant income threshold of $31,340, Shauna is eligible for the opportunity grant. She filed her FAFSA on February 2nd, well before the March 13th cutoff date for students attending four-year private independent institutions. She listed one Oregon school on her FAFSA, but based on her FAFSA filing, she would have been eligible for an opportunity grant at any participating high school. However, if she had filed her FAFSA after March 13th, she would have not been eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant at that private institution. And then the three calculations in the tables below are her cost of college, her preferred school, the private institution, her cost of attendance is $29,000. That's the tuition and fees and the non-educational expenses that I described before. She's eligible for the maximum federal Pell Grant, She can take out a federal Stafford loan when the amount for her grade level is $3,500 her year in school. And she will receive an Oregon Opportunity Grant of $3,170. And again, remember, that's based specifically on the cost of attendance at that institution. It's tied to that institution. If she were attending a four-year public school, her Oregon Opportunity Grant would be $1,482. And if she were going to community college, it would be $1,257. I'll pause for questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shields.
Thank you. Do you have any sense of if there are more scholarship opportunities at, say, Reed or University of Portland than there might be at the state universities?
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, I think I'll ask Commissioner Clem to help me with this, but I think it would depend upon the public institution that you were referring to. Some of the public institutions have very well endowed foundations, as well as do the privates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Brian Clem, and I am the chair of the commission. It does vary by institution, but I'll give you an example. I was at Willamette eating dinner at an event, and the president of Willamette said, at my campus, we gave out 93% of our students got some financial aid. And so they obviously have a real commitment and a fundraising sort of effort that can do that on that campus. If you talk to somebody at Western Baptist College, for example, an independent school, very little campus-based aid is available to them. So it really ranges. And I think the same thing applies to public schools. I graduated from Oregon State. Our foundation has made, and the president the last few years, has made efforts to try and do more campus-based scholarships. But I would say overall, you're going to find a lot more campus-based aid available at private schools on sort of a proportional basis. The sheer number of scholarships would be higher because you're talking about 20,000 people, you know, at OSU versus 1,200 or 1,500 at Willamette. But it's going to be much significant higher dollar amounts. And I think they had $21 million of aid delivered last year at Willamette. And our opportunity grant for the whole state was only $22 million.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll continue with the student number two, Carl. Carl's a 31-year-old single independent student. He has no dependents. He lost his factory job due to company downsizing. Losing his job gave him an opportunity to retrain for a new career, and he chose to go to college at a four-year public institution to finish a baccalaureate degree in engineering. Carl's income is $5,182. His federally calculated expected family contribution is zero, which also makes him eligible for the maximum Pell Grant of $4,050. Since his income falls well below the $8,740, the income threshold for a single independent student, he is also eligible for an opportunity grant. Carl filed his FAFSA on February 6, well before the cutoff date of April 21st for students attending a four-year public institution. And that was the only school he listed is the one he's currently attending. Based on his FAFSA filing date, however, he would have been eligible for an opportunity grant at any participating Oregon school. So you'll see his preferred school is a public four-year at $15,400. His Pell Grant is $4,050. His federal Stafford loan, as a single independent, he can borrow $10,500. And his Oregon Opportunity Grant is $1,482. Student number three is Linda, a 44-year-old single parent, starting her second year at community college. Linda's income is $18,720. Linda's federally calculated expected family contribution is zero, which again qualifies her for the federal maximum Pell Grant of $4,050. There are two people in Linda's household, one in college and one in middle school. The income threshold for an independent student in a two-person household is $19,330, so Linda qualifies for the opportunity grant. She filed her FAFSA on July 16th, less than a month before the cutoff date for community college students, but nearly 3 months after the cutoff dates for four-year public and private institutions. Based on her FAFSA filing date, she would only be eligible to receive the opportunity grant at a community college. You can see at her preferred school, the community college, her cost of attendance is $11,900. Her federal Pell Grant, $4,050. She can take out a federal Stafford loan of $7,500. And her opportunity grant is $1,257. Student number four. Alex. Alex is a 19-year-old dependent student who's about to start his first year at a four-year private independent institution. His family income is $42,259. He earned $2,377 from a summer job. Alex's federal calculated expected family contribution is $908, which qualifies him for a Pell Grant of $3,100. So you can see here when his family contribution just went up even close to the $1,000 range, his Pell Grant is reduced because the Pell Grant is on a step system. There are seven members in Alex's family with one in college. The income threshold for his family is $42,310, which makes Alex eligible for an opportunity grant. He filed his FAFSA on January 8th. He listed four colleges and two out-of-state schools. Based on the date he filed his FAFSA, he would be eligible to receive the opportunity grant at any of the Oregon schools he listed. His preferred school, the cost of attendance is $26,000. His federal Pell Grant, $3,100. He can take out a federal Stafford loan of $2,625. You'll note that's much lower for a dependent student than an independent student. And his opportunity grant, based on the particular private institution he's attending, is $2,700.
Any questions?
If Sean or Linda, Carl or Alex get a job.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I have a question.
Okay.
Glad we're not fined for violating protocol.
Could I make that
we
can
add that to it.
Almost forgot the question. If any one of these four students goes to work and is employed during the school year, does that impact the Pell Grant, the Stafford loan, or the Oregon Opportunity Grant if they generate income during the course of the school year?
Madam Chair, Representative Dallum, it certainly could the following year. The eligibility through the free application for federal student aid, or the FAFSA, is based on the prior year. So students filling out their FAFSA right now beginning in January 2005 for the school year 05-06, their eligibility is based on their 2004 income and assets.
Okay. Just a quick question. Now, in the instance where between Pell Grant, Stafford Loan, and Opportunity Grant, the student would exceed the tuition for their preferred school, there are excess funds available. And how are those considered?
Madam Chair, usually then the loans are reduced.
If
they would only be awarded the amount of loans up to the cost of attendance determined by the institution. The institution does the financial packaging for the student.
I see. Thank you.
If I might, Madam Chair, I think this speaks to the earlier question you asked, too. Every single student gets looked at by a financial aid officer and the mix of things they may get. So when you talk about equalizing, you ask about is there going to be overage, a financial aid officer offers a package to an individual student on a one-on-one basis that says, look, I see here you've gotten this local scholarship. I see you've gotten this, you know, parental income that you ought to be able to contribute. I see here you're working, work study for 10 hours. What's left then is this need that the school is going to see if we can't have the state pick up, or we're going to pick up, or you're going to have to figure out some other way to finance it yourself with an alternative loan. So it's very efficient because every single one is individual. And we have a grant that can fill in gaps when someone meets the need income. If it goes over their costs, it might go to their books, which in our public hearings we found aren't really accounted for in the tuition and fee number, but they're hugely expensive now. I mean, $100 and $150 a book, and they have to get a new one every other year. And it's almost a scandal, actually, the textbook issue. And so that's what really kind of goes on a campus, or every student's needs are looked at individually, and then we see what we can do to make them whole. And And too often in the past, the state hasn't been able to really finish because we run out of money in March.
I'm beginning to read your body language and your nuancing.
Very excited about this.
Next.
Do you have any figures for the threshold? When a student passes the threshold, for example, Alex, Carl, Linda, Shauna, I want to know about the next person up, the one that doesn't make the threshold. So that we have a student that would make the cut. How much out of pocket does the one that doesn't make the cut have to pay? And what kind of a position does this put them in? Have we created another class of needy student somewhere between average income and that doesn't make the cut?
Madam Chairman, Representative Dallin, you point out a really important policy choice that those financial aid officers face on a student-by-student basis, but we as a state face on the broader population issues. We have many students who are eligible, but because of our limited resources, we have to establish these cutoffs in terms of date of application for financial aid through that federal process. It's one that we have to exclude people because our resources are limited under the current appropriation that we have. That is one of the things that we hope to be able to move beyond to go to year-round eligibility with the resources that are proposed in the governor's budget so that we won't have to use those cutoff dates. And right now, we encourage students to apply as soon as possible. January 1st is the date you ought to be filling out your FAFSA form. And as students do that earlier and earlier, then we have to move up the cutoff dates earlier and earlier if our resources aren't expanded to be able to meet more of the need. And so it's a bit of a dilemma that we get caught in when the resources are so limited. Folks will tell you that high school counselors, school financial aid officers all really stress the importance of families taking their estimated income taxes from the prior year, a small update. Don't wait until you get those final tax forms from your banks or your employer to do your FAFSA form. You need to do that way before you do your taxes because of these key cutoff dates. That people, if you wait until you do your taxes April 15th, you're going to be way too late for many of these aid opportunities.
Non-related question, but somewhat related. When to do the guaranteed student loan, Pell or Stafford, can you tell me what percentage of those students go into forbearance and what the cure rate and finally what the ultimate default rate is? Do you have any notion of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dallin, I don't have that data specifically. We can tell you what that data is, after the hearing's over, by going back and doing some research on what our default rates are by these different sectors for those students who've actually used the Oregon Student Assistance Commission as their loan guarantee agency. But we don't have the data for the whole state of Oregon because many of the schools do not use OSAC as a guarantor.
Follow-up question. If that's not a major undertaking, I'd like to look at it.
The default rates are data that we retain and record, so that's available.
And perhaps, Ms. Lau, you could make that available through Jim Keller. Thank you.
Certainly.
Madam Chair.
Representative Roblin.
Again, I appreciate having people here. Brian actually is a student at Marshfield High School, so I like to acknowledge that. And with Aspire, which we'll probably hear some things. Just a couple of years ago, right? Yeah. The issue that I think we really need to say, these are kind of the most needy kids that apply. And in every case, there was a loan. So there's no one in this group who is not paying for part of their education. And many of the people, from our perspective, and I guess I've said from years, seeing that loan is still a big hindrance to a lot of kids who come from families that have had a difficult time making a decision to go to college and making a decision for a loan. But again, even our poorest that have zero contribution had to come up with a loan of some sort at any one of the institutions they went to. And I just like to make sure that everybody understands. And I think that was kind of what Mr. Dahlman was getting at as well, that here are these people who haven't in their families necessarily done loans, and they're going to have something to pay back when they get done. And in every case. And are there any cases where they don't, that you have nowadays, that they are... Not excluding the idea that there are some other finances that they could have gotten from other schools, like Willamette, that you already mentioned. But,
sure,
you
know. Madam Chair, unless they get a private scholarship like the Ford Foundation that has a full needs test and then they commit to meeting your need, no one who's getting just government programs or aid is ever going to, in these days of the cost of tuition, going to be able to just get grants to cover it. It's not even close. I mean, they're going to be expected to work in almost all cases. They're going to be expected to work during the summers and probably while they're at school. And that's got an effect on their ability to succeed in their grades. And unless you're one of the few who get a major private donor to say, I'm going to basically take care of you the whole way through, you're going to take loans and you're going to work during the summer and while you're in school most of the time. Very few people wouldn't fit that bill. I did, and my tuition was a third of what it is now. And I worked work study, and I worked every summer, and all that was factored into what I was expected to contribute. To me, it was still worth it, obviously. And I got a need grant. I got every need-based program you could get. And, you know, I'd be still in Coos Bay waiting for a mill to reopen if it wasn't for this grant. You know, it's been 15 years since I got it, and now I own a business in Salem, and we run an orchard in Hood River. None of those things would have been possible without this grant. And, you know, the economy changes a lot. I didn't think I was going to be in farming, but I married a farmer's daughter. And I didn't study horticulture. I studied politics.
This could take an interesting turn, however.
Tell us a story about the farmer.
However. Representative Farr.
I just wanted to make a comment because Representative Dahlem asked what the failure rate on the Stafford loan. The Stafford and then Perkins isn't listed here, but that would be included. But that doesn't have anything to do with state monies. That's all federal dollars.
It's a federal loan program that's administered by campuses, yeah, but it's not state of Oregon finances.
Well, the other final comment, if I may, Madam Chair, this is called the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and the purpose of it is to provide opportunities for higher education for children that would not have had those opportunities otherwise. So I think it's important for the record that we remember that.
Thank you very much. Did you have any further, Ms. Merkel?
No, I did not. Thank you.
We wanted to go over the last page because this is something that you will probably hear about a considerable amount as you move into the deliberations around the proposed changes to the opportunity grant. And that is where these students go to school, not on a student-by-student basis, but on a more aggregate basis by the different sectors. And where are applicants coming from, and then where do the dollars go? Because since the dollar grants are not equal between the different sectors, all of those end up looking a little bit differently. I'm a strong believer in a picture's worth a thousand words, so we put these into some pie charts for you as the last page of the stapled together handout. As you can see, over half of the applicants for the opportunity grant are represented in the community college sector. And in terms of recipients, also over half of the recipients are also community college students. The numbers are smaller in terms of proportion in terms of applicants and recipients in the independent colleges, but the dollars individually for the independent colleges on a grant-by-grant basis are higher at this present time. The group that, in terms of you look at by institution, what institution has the most recipients, those would be the two state large four-year public institutions, the U of O and Oregon State. But you will probably hear a considerable amount about how the resources are allocated by sector. We really have tried to make sure that we've maintained as much equity as possible given the current statutory requirements around the program. And the changes that are proposed in the governor's budget also create some opportunity for reviewing those. And in fact, during the last session, the commission was charged in Senate Bill 437 to review that. And we'll be sending a report to the committee early next week, as well as the rest of the members of the legislature that summarizes those deliberations. With that, that concludes our specific presentation. We did provide for you also a handout which really addresses how Oregon's system of higher education is scored based on a national review of their counterparts across the country. And, you know, in many areas, the states, you know, in terms of participation, Oregon gets a fairly strong score of a B minus. But when it comes to affordability, this is a place where Oregon schools are viewed as the weakest. The F grade is not one that we want to retain, and so the governor is really doing everything he can in terms of trying to improve how we stack up against our competitors across the country. One of the things that we know is that our best and brightest students are looking at educational opportunities across the country, and when we don't have the ability to provide incentives to keep our best and brightest in Oregon, we tend to lose those to those other states. And many times where you go to school also then determines where you find employment and create jobs. So we really do want to create the economic incentive, short-term and long-term, to keep students in Oregon and improving their skills and marketability, because it's good for the state altogether as well as them individually. With that, that concludes our planned remarks today, and we'll be glad to answer any further questions from the committee.
Thank you. Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is directed at the Chair, Commissioner Clem. Since you were here during the last budget cycle, and I don't believe, Marjorie, you were in charge of the commission at that time. But we had a lot of discussion around how that 11% flat figure, and I notice if you sort of do a quick division on the number of grant recipients by the amount of funds, they kind of break down at about 850, 1250, and 2780 plus or minus. So there's a considerable amount of difference that goes to a student, say, in a private institution as opposed to a public institution. And is maybe I'm trying to steal some of the thunder of your report that's coming out, but do you have any points for the committee to consider around that issue?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I'll try and not let you steal too much thunder here. We held a series of basically public hearings all around the state, and I traveled, I think, to eight cities by the time it was done, and several different venues, campuses, and libraries, and listened to folks on this topic. There was another group called the Access and Affordability Work Group that was part of the Oregon University System effort to re-engineer itself, and it also entertained this topic. And what I would prefer to do is essentially say that we do believe that it ought to be a similar amount no matter where you go. But how you get there is what will be the recommendation of our report. The preference would be to bring people up rather than take people down, and to grandfather in people who might be harmed to the greatest extent possible. But generally speaking, we do believe that the grant ought to try and move to a relatively equal amount, that then you choose to go where you want with that amount and not have it quite based so much on the cost of attending that institution. It's the implementation that becomes the trick.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, and I'd just like to thank you for your service on this commission. I mean, it's you're volunteering, and I know you've volunteered a lot of time.
Well, thank you very much. I did want to introduce a few of my commissioners who are here too: Dean Wendell and Jesse Lorke from Grants Pass. Dean, he's the vice chair of the commission. Jesse's our student commissioner. He has attended, boy, now I think a community college, a 4-year private and a 4-year public, and you know, to best meet his needs, he's at Portland State now.
Do we have, does that mean he's a 10-year student?
No, he's probably going to finish in 4 still. But he was also a submarine operator in the, I guess it's the Navy, right? So he's got interesting stories to tell at some point. There was a couple other things that I wanted to just hit, if I could. The commission is a volunteer board, and it provides governance for the agency and also sets policy around the different questions, like, you know, what's the grant size going to be for a given year? Which sector is going to get more or less, although there are some statutes that govern that. And it's not always fun. I mean, we had to send a Christmas letter a couple years ago letting people know the grant for the next term was going to be reduced because it was a recession, and we were running out of money to even meet the needs we'd committed to the year before. So signing that letter was not the highlight of my experience, but it's very rewarding for people, especially people like me who actually received aid and scholarships from this particular commission, that we do something to give back. And so anyone that volunteers for our commission, you're going to find is really dedicated to this, and it doesn't feel like a chore or a burden. It's a real passion. And our staff is that way too. They are not what I would call, you know, sort of career people for public service in general. They almost always are our former recipient of financial aid who cares very deeply and has made their whole career financial aid. And so it's a very specific and unique type of person who wants to be involved in this, and usually someone who feels like they owe something back. The other thing about the commission that we've tried to do over the last couple of years is study, at the request of, he was then Representative Schrader, now Senator Schrader, the effectiveness of the grant and whether it really actually makes a difference or not. And so we did a report that tracked students who received the grant and people who were eligible and didn't receive it because we ran out of money, basically. And there was almost a 30% increase in people attending college that next fall if they got the grant than if they didn't get this one grant. And that means they got all the other aid, but this $1,000 or $1,200 grant, they didn't go to school, one out of three, just because they didn't get it. And, you know, so when you look at Alex and Tina and Linda and Carl, two of them would probably be gone if the grant isn't funded fully, because they just decide that it's too big of a hurdle. And there's something about the state saying, I'm going to invest a grant in you rather than say it's a private good and we'll make you a loan, that makes you really want to excel. Kind of like when you get a private scholarship, even if it's small, it makes you want to achieve because somebody believed in you. The other thing that you'll hear more about as we go along are the other efforts to re-engineer the grant. We're going to start testing students' assets. That was something that came out of the OUS board's recommendations. And in the long term, we're going to look at ways to really figure out exactly how much that grant size needs to be based on their other financial aid, and maybe be able to get into a variable grant where we can make that last dollar. But right now we're still working on the modeling because it's incredibly intensive to try and figure that out for hundreds of thousands of people. Other than that, that's all I think I've got to contribute. I really look at this grant from a personal side and what it did for me, but I'm a business owner, and I really think about what it means to have human capital wasted. And for me, people have promise and opportunity and would make other business owners employees, and if the only thing that's limiting them from becoming entrepreneurs or teachers or business owners is $1,000 or $2,000 worth of money from the state, and then in 4 years they're out and they're earning all this higher income and paying back the income tax revenue, to me it's a good investment. It's the kind of thing that, you know, if someone made a mutual fund out of it, I would contribute to it because it's a lot better than my Microsoft stock at the moment.
Well, obviously there must be a connection between the opportunity and the hand up and the significant work ethic that you have demonstrated. So if we could clone that, we're in. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two small questions. And the first Oregon Opportunity Grant, and it's got to be a resident of Oregon. How many years or months do they have to establish as a resident of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, they have to be a 12-month resident if they're a dependent student, okay. And I believe it's 6 months?
It's still 12.
It's still 12 if an independent student.
Okay, and the second question, follow up on that. Do you have any affirmative program, such as the minorities give any preference on this opportunity grant or federal Pell Grant, whatever?
We don't consider race at all in our formulas, but what I can tell you that I have done myself personally, because there was another senator who was real interested. My wife is Asian American, and she's the chair of the Commission on Asian Affairs, and she and I have talked about the outreach efforts sometimes that go on. So it's not that the grant would be tilted, but sometimes certain communities, they don't get their information in the same place that other folks do. So this last year, I went to the Asian Family Center, three or four different organizations in the African American community up in Portland, and I said, you know, I don't know if the high schools are meeting your needs, but just in case they're not, why don't we put a kiosk about our scholarships and our grants in your facility too, because these are places where people are gathering already to learn about how to improve their lives. Places like the Work Opportunity Center in Portland or Self Enhancement Inc., we put one there. So the outreach we do is in every high school we make our information available. We have a program called Aspire that, as we, and Vicky invented it, it's incredible. We counsel individual students and provide assistance to high school counseling offices on all of our programs. And then I just made the extra effort at the request of Senator Gordley to think about people who don't get their information in traditional ways. Maybe their parents don't speak English and they were an immigrant, you know, in the 70s from Vietnam, evacuated or something. Let's get some of these materials in their particular places that they go when they're thinking about how to improve their lives. So we do some of those extra outreach efforts there, but the grant itself doesn't factor race at all.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anything in the federal regulations that require that we have the grants also open to private institutions?
No, that's a state policy choice that's been made. It's not required.
And that's in statute, I presume.
Madam Chair, Representative Shields, I believe that it is in statute in terms of the eligibility of the private institutions for the grant. There's also statutory language which speaks to how the Commission needs to make its allocation decisions. There is some flexibility within those statutes around parameters, but we do need to consider all three sectors.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything further?
Madam Chair, I have a question. Regarding the 12-month requirement, now I assume there are other states that have a grant program similar to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Are their residency requirements the same?
I would suspect they are, and people, you know, this is like the old Rajneesh thing. Do people move here just to get a $1,000 grant? I don't think that if that's what you're worried about, that's what happens. I think Washington, California are probably real similar.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, the states actually have a wide variety of ways that they design and administer their state need grants. We probably most look like the state of Washington has been my experience so far.
Would it be possible for you to get us that information about how other states are using their program and what the requirements are?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, certainly. And if you were kind of state shopping to decide where you could get the best need grant, there are several states that do way better than we do. So we'll also provide the committee with some of that information as well.
Well, I hope you understand I was playing the devil's advocate here.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything further? Thank you very much, panel. It's been very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, and thank you, Representative March, officially and on the record, for recommending that we hear this information. I think it would be very helpful as we go forward in our contemplations in this particular issue. So nothing further to come before this committee. It stands adjourned.
That's nice.